It is my privilege and my honor to introduce to you Greg Palast. Please put your hands together and welcome Greg.
Hey. Wow, thank you, Joanne from KABU, your weapon of mass instruction. One more time, I want to see those hands of people who are members. Now I want to see the hands of people who aren't. I want your names. This is an investigative report here, man. I know who you are, and I know what station you're listening to and not paying for. We'll talk about that. Wow. First of all, thanks again. Where's Dave Mazza? Thank you very much again. From the Portland Alliance. Portland Alliance. We also had Demetrius DeSillis of Rear Guard, who was our principal sponsor here tonight. Demetrius, who's been, where is Demetrius? Heroes, Giants here. There he is. Demetrius. The real paper of this, you know, it's, if you're reading the Oregonian, Looking Glass Books, who will, by the way, thanks to Looking Glass, who will be donating proceeds from sales to these organizations. All the money tonight is going to benefit Rear Guard and the Portland Alliance and KABU and, terrific, and also thanks to my associate who lives here in Oregon, Kat Lestrange, for putting this together. And a special thanks, I guess in Oregon it was the shed that wouldn't let me, I'm supposed to be at the shed tomorrow, but they have kicked me out, but we've moved over to, so let your friends know I'll be at, is it Portland State University? What is it? University of Oregon, the shed has shown their class interests. Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe we should just go. I don't know why you're here, you know. Because didn't Catherine Harris tell you to move on? I mean, you know, get over it, right? So how many of you heard our president last week, you know, his high noon speech, 48 hours for Saddam to get out of town? And by the way, he said, Saddam and inspectors and journalists. But he said this. He said, I want to talk. I actually looked up. I couldn't believe what he said, so I had to get the paper record. He said, I want to talk to the Iraqi people. Okay. Cheney forgot to mention that they speak Arabic. It's okay. And I thought, man, you know, okay, he's going to say something, you know, especially because, you know, the mothers and fathers of the kids who are being sent into the bullets are listening in. I thought he might say something, you know, I expect him to say the usual stuff, like, listen, our kids are here to liberate you from this monster, so, don't shoot at them. Instead, he said, do not destroy oil wells. I can't make this up. Do not destroy oil wells. Anyway, so it was translated to Arabic by Al-Qaeda immediately. And then he said we're going after those who have, look at this. You gotta see this, man. He's going after those who have aided, trained, and harbored terrorists, including operatives of Al-Qaeda. I thought, shit, he's gonna bust his daddy. Right? That's courageous. I mean, that's a man for all, you know, Easter dinner, you can imagine, spread him, dad. Up against the wall. read him his rights. Says it. And then he said here, war. War has no certainty except the certainty of sacrifice. And, you know, and I guess he would know, you know, he was a war hero himself during Vietnam. I heard laughter. You know, he was. No, he was a fighter pilot during the war in Vietnam, and the Texas Air Guard, which is kind of a weekend war hawks army for those afraid of the, you know, warriors afraid of the sight of blood, especially their own. And he was actually quite fearsome, actually, during the war. In fact, his reputation as a fighter pilot was so fierce that the Viet Cong didn't even dream of attacking San Antonio, you know. And I was bringing this up here because I'm at this school, you know, because our president's very concerned. He's fighting in the midst of everything he's doing, you know, Bush at war. He's fighting on three fronts. He's fighting the war against Saddam, the war against Osama, the war against affirmative action, right? Right? You know, he's very concerned. He's been to places like this, seen too many black kids in college, and he immediately said he's fighting affirmative action. And because he says no one should have their position except through merit. I know what you're thinking, but it's not true. He actually had to take a test. I looked this up, I'm, you know, investigative reporter, all that stuff. I looked it up, he did take a test to get into the Texas Air Guard, and out of a possible 100, he scored 25. Now there were thousands of brave chicken hawks who wanted to be in Texas Air Guard during the war in Vietnam, during the war, and thousands got higher scores, but they didn't get the Top Gun Tom Cruise job because many of them were people, students of color, and they had an affirmative action program at the time called Vietnam, right? And now, one wonders, as we watch Bush courageously send other men, other kids, into Baghdad, and, you know, I was thinking, Napoleon always made sure that his was the first horse into battle, and Bush is riding Dick Cheney, the last jackass, away from him. But anyway. But in Texas, during the war in Vietnam, see, this may go back some time. You don't think that Bush used some affirmative action from his powerful congressman father to get out of the war, right? So I kind of looked into this, and I was investigating into that question. And see, the Democrats were afraid to bring that up during the very close election in 94 against in which he just won by a hair, because they had no evidence. They didn't know how he got that nice, safe Top Gun job at the Air Guard. But one guy knew, and his name was Ben Barnes. I want to explain how this works, see, how it works. Okay? And Ben Barnes knew, and after W was elected, Ben Barnes called up the governor's office, the new governor. See, because Ben Barnes was a lobbyist for a company called G-Tech Corporation, which had just been removed for corruption for running the Texas State Lottery worth $1 billion a year to that company, but they're removed for corruption, and a new company was put in by the new lottery director, and Ben called, and he said, he reminded those in his office that he was lieutenant governor during the war in Vietnam of Texas, and he happened to make a call to the general, to a guy, General Craig Rose, head of the Texas Air Guard, suggesting that young son of Congressman Bush is best having his skinny white bottom protecting Texas rather than going into the jungle. And he wanted to remind the governor's office of that, and that he had not mentioned this to anyone. He not mentioned this to anyone. And he also then, they agreed to remember that Barnes called the general without ever hearing from a member of the Bush family. It just came into his head, a kind of Texas telepathy. The governor was ever grateful for him remembering that he did not get a call, and the Texas Lottery Commission fired the lottery director that got rid of G-Tech and gave the corrupt corporation G-Tech a renewed contract in perpetuity, no bid, and Ben Barnes received a fee of $23 million from G-Tech. And now, I had this information, but now what I don't want you to do is make a connection between the $23 million and our hero's war record that it was bought. But I thought that you should know what can be paid to keep someone out of war. See, so he's the ultimate. He will go to great lengths to avoid war if he has to be in it. So now, one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight is who's winning the war, right? Who's winning the war? You know, all you peaceniks, you want peace, but come on. Someone's going to win. Put down your bets. Who won the first Gulf War? Does anyone remember? Who won Gulf War Part 1, Round 1? And well, Saddam, okay, he did pretty well. How about Chevron Oil? After Daddy, well, remember, it was supposed to be the Kuwaitis, right? They were going to get democracy. Remember democracy? And the women were driving cars, and they were going to democratize. They were going to have a democratic monarchy and all that stuff. But I'm waiting. It's been 12 years. Anyone seen the election returns from Kuwait? So that was democracy, just like we brought democracy to Afghanistan. One warlord, one vote. Right? And now we're bringing democracy to Baghdad. They're going to have an unknown number of years under a guy from Texas named Tommy Franks, the head of our military, which is very interesting, because then we'll have, after we depose Saddam Hussein, there'll be Tommy Franks, General Tommy Franks in charge. The Iraqis have been already told. And he will be assisted, by the way, by, they've already designated an executive from Phillips Petroleum and British Petroleum, there's an alliance, to run the oil fields. But that means that Iraq will then have a military dictator with weapons of mass destruction. So are we going to have to take out, like, Tommy Franks, So anyway, who won? So what happened in Kuwait is that after Daddy Bush left the White House, left, two-thirds of the American public rose up and said, out. And there's hope. Keep hope alive. Our Desert Stormtrooper took some stationery with him as he left the Oval Office and wrote a letter to the Kuwaiti royals, the dictators in robes. He didn't remind them, by the way. He said, our guys went into the desert for your democracy. He didn't say anything about that. He wrote them a letter saying, the royals, Daddy Bush, please give an oil concession to Chevron Oil Company. Now, he promised when he left the White House he wouldn't lobby for any corporations. What's the letter about? Well, he said, I didn't get a dime. That's true. Now, his son got $660,000 from Chevron for his campaign for president. But, I don't want... I see your face. I can see you're making a connection between the two-thirds of a million-dollar donation and the deal for Chevron Oil. But there is no connection. Yes. Okay, so who else is winning? So who's going to win? We now know who won Gulf War Part 1, Chevron and the Republican National Campaign Treasury. So who's going to win? Oh, by the way, there was another winner. Right after the Gulf War, two guys were seen sneaking across the desert in saddle shoes and salesman's bags, Marvin and Neil Bush, who were selling pipeline systems in Arabia for Enron Corporation. And some radical commentator, I think it was Howard Zinn, said, do we send a 500,000 boys into the desert so that the Bush family could ring the cash register? Actually, it wasn't Howard Zinn. It was Norman Schwarzkopf made that comment. We haven't heard from him since. Missing in action. He's a big guy to hide. I wonder how they did it. So who's won? Who's going to win part two, Gulf War part two? I don't want any nominations for part three, part four. We'll be meeting again for that one next year. Halliburton, I got a nomination. Bechtel, I got, that's a good one. Any others? Carlyle, that's a good one. Carlyle Corporation, okay, that would be one. Actually, our president just asked Congress for $75 billion and they turned it down. They gave him $80 billion. And not that they're slavish lapdogs. But you know what it's for? This is very important because, you know, times are tough. And we just, 2 weeks ago, announced that women on Medicaid, pregnant women on Medicaid, will no longer receive medical care. And of course, the Portland School District is safe now from attack by Saddam. And school year is a little short, I understand. But we still got $450 million in this little package for a company called Carlyle for a weapon called the Crusader. And nearly $500 million, which is which is a great name for a weapon as you're about to attack another Muslim country, right? The Crusader. Richard the Lionhearted machine. But it's actually a self-propelled howitzer, what it's called, kind of a tank. The problem is that the self-propelled howitzer doesn't propel itself so well. It's kind of clunky. So you have to put a bulldozer in front of it to clear a path. And the military dictator designate Tommy Franks of Iraq has said that even he doesn't want this thing, because he can't find any guys to go into the bulldozer. You know? And so they got $450 million to wind down the project. You know? Hey, when I wind down, I get a glass of wine and veg out in front of the tube or something, you know? They get $500 million. Nothing to do, by the way, with the fact that Daddy Bush is on their payroll as an arms dealer to Saudi Arabia and Asia, or that his son, our president, was actually also on the payroll of Carlyle Group, and he was put on the board of one of their subsidiaries. Now, this was merit. I don't want anyone to think there's affirmative action going on here, that he was put on because of his business acumen, which, and it's not his fault that the company almost immediately went bankrupt. And sharp as marble. And 25 out of 100, right? If it's multiple choice, that's like random. I don't get it. Other nominations? My personal favorite, front runner for me, is Lockheed Corporation. I've gone through the lifetime with givers to the Bush political campaigns. They're way up near the top, Lockheed. And they've got, now they're coming in on the new extra money to fight the war on terror. The Virginia-class submarine, which was designed to hunt Soviet subs, which, you know, there aren't any Soviet subs, so that doesn't stop these patriots. What they've got, they've reconfigured this to be a mean, lean war on terror machine. And they, you know, first it was like for Afghanistan, then I showed them the map, it's landlocked. But then they showed me the map of Iraq, which has a little beach at the end. If you look at those maps, it has a little beach, and they said, we can land. What we're going to do is we're going to change this machine. It's going to now, it's been reconfigured to land commandos on the beach to fight, the cells of terrorists and bad guys. And I said, what? I said, okay, the Israelis, they don't have as much big a budget. They use canoes. But And I said, so, but the main thing is, you know, one of these suckers is as big as this gymnasium, bigger, right? And I said, how do you sneak it up to the beach, right? And they said, Mr. Palast, now don't be ridiculous. We wouldn't sneak the sub up to the beach. We've reconfigured the torpedoes to stick 9 Marines in them. We shoot them. I don't make this up. I don't make this up. $1.5 billion a boat. And our president thought this was so neat, he's ordered 3 dozen. Maybe we can hold classes inside the boats. Oh, by the way, you know how you get the guys into the torpedoes? You don't go into the torpedo, you go in the bulldozer, right? Any other winners? Richard Pearl from a nominee from that. Yeah, Richard Pearl and Adnan Khashoggi. My colleague Cy Hirsch, lucky guy, another one fired from the New York Times, exposed a deal between Richard Pearl, who's the guy who conceived of the war, who said we had to attack Iraq because of September 11th. He wrote this 4 years ago. No one's asked that question. And he set up a partnership to help nations fight terrorism with Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi arms dealer who arms the terrorists. See, so it's a win-win situation. But he had to resign Pearl from the Defense Advisory Committee's chairmanship. He's still on it because of his financial relationship with this creepy criminal arms dealer from Saudi Arabia. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. I've been doing some investigation, and I was looking at donors to George W. Bush's campaign. I find a company called Barrick Gold Mining of Canada, and I said, why are they donating to little George's campaign? And sure enough, on their international advisory board is a guy named George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, who's Barrick Gold Mine? There's no Joe Barrick, I find out. It is founded and funded by that well-known Canadian, Adnan Khashoggi. So in other words, so this raised a real serious question for me. Presidential daddy goes to work for the company that Khashoggi financed. Now, does that mean that he has to resign his first father? You know, but I was interested in that. I you have to understand how the Bush family works. See, war is a profit center. The Oval Office is a subsidiary of Bush Inc. But I understand that. But what I didn't understand is what this company, you know, what does Adnan do with a used president, right? And lo and behold, I look. And by the way, tell me if I'm too loud or too soft back there, or too annoying, or too subversive. Can't be too subversive today. And lo and behold, just before Bush is pushed out of office, he changes the rules for gold mining companies to stake claims. And in Nevada, because of this rules change, the prospectors in the gold rush days used to, you know, find a nugget of gold in a pan and run off to the claims office going, Eureka, we found it, put down $5, they get an acre of land to mine. Well, Barrick Gold Mining was able to say, Eureka, we found them, and took Bush to the claims office, put down $10,000, and got claim to the largest gold mine in this hemisphere, $10 billion worth of gold ore. 10 grand. Nice. Then Daddy got the job with them. And now, I reported that. Did you see it in the Oregonian? No. I reported that in Britain, in The Observer. Until recently, I had George Orwell's old job, actually, as columnist. It's like we're still there. I said, George, you'll like this one. $10,000, $10 billion worth of gold. Daddy gets a job. I reported that in the Observer, and Bush's gold fingers sued us. They sued my paper, the Observer, and the Guardian, which is the weekday paper in the website. And just like Richard Pearl is suing the New Yorker and Seymour Hersh for that story in Britain, because there's no First Amendment in Britain. There is no written constitution there, by the way. The USA is fantastic because we literally are the only country on this planet with a freedom, with a right to freedom of speech and freedom of press. I take that pretty seriously, and I'm campaigning for that in Britain. If you read the book, the last chapter, I'm campaigning for that in Britain, and you know, that they need a First Amendment. They can borrow ours, we're not using it, right? So I've been sued by these guys because they said, they didn't deny that Bush got the $10,000, that Bush got the job, that they put down $10,000 for a claim at Nakashoggi, the gold mine. But they said any reasonable person under British law, I'd be liable, because they said any reasonable person reading these facts, gold mine, the job, would conclude that they're connected. So I let my paper, I told my paper, go ahead, because one of the reasons, like KABU, the Observer and Guardian, are run by a not-for-profit foundation. So, you know, it gives me a lot of freedom, but not a lot of cash to defend against armed and dangerous billionaires. So we signed a paper saying that there was no connection to the courts. So I want you to think about that a minute, which is, let's see, W got the donations, and Barrick got the gold mine, the public got the shaft, Poppy got the job, and there's no connections, right? Which still didn't answer for me why, you know, what are they going to do with this used president? Is this clearer when I talk this way? No. Okay. So I looked, and on their website said that Bush and his company and his the international advisors helped the company Barrick get a gold mining concession in Tanzania. I said, what's that about? What do they need him for? The answer is a very politically sensitive situation, because Barrick was trying to buy a property from another company, but it was worthless because there were Tanzanians already mining it. They had, you know, the miners, the prospectors with their little claims and their little pits and hats and mules, Tanzanians, which creates a very uncomfortable situation in which the Bush and the Canadians and the Saudis' gold were underneath all these Tanzanians in Tanzania. So they decided to move them out, and the company that they're bargaining with, realizing they couldn't make the sale unless they cleared it, so they moved bulldozers across the property. August 1996. They smashed down all the workers' houses. They destroyed their mining equipment. Military police firing weapons. They filled in their mining pits with the bulldozers and cleared out more than 30,000 miners. All but 50, because 50 were still in the pits when they covered them over. And I reported that too. And they sued me. They sued the paper. And they said, okay, give me your side of the story. They said, there's no side. We want you to sign a document that says that you can, quote, happily confirm that no one died in the peaceful clearance of the mines. I said, what's your evidence? And they said, our evidence is we're billionaires, you're not signed. I said, I need a little bit more than that. So I encouraged, and our paper encouraged, a guy named Tundu Lissu, L-I-S-S-U. And I want you to remember his name, L-I-S-S-U. He was especially qualified because he is the, one of the top attorneys on the planet out of World Resources Institute on environment and human rights, and he also has a Tanzanian law degree, and he speaks Swahili, perfect guy to send with his stature to the mines to find out the real story. And he sent back to me, I said, okay, if it's bogus, tell me. He sent back to me pictures of crushed corpses. He sent back to me videotape
of body parts being exhumed, and he sent back witness statements signed from Tanzanians, including one who took 4 days to dig out of one of the pits, made it. And so I brought it to Barrick, to Bush's boys, and I said, what do you say? And they said, fine, sign it. You can happily confirm that no one died in the peaceful clearance of the mine. I said, I can't do that. And I couldn't do it, not because I'm some great man for all seasons. I was bleeding money, and so is the paper. But it was because Tundu Lissu, just before he left Tanzania, held a press conference with his law partners in Dar es Salaam and said in Swahili, we now have evidence which suggests that there ought to be an investigation of the facts surrounding the clearance of the mine at Bulyanhulu. And for that, he was charged with sedition by the government. So I couldn't sign a paper that would hang him, literally. But as it turns out, by the way, one lucky thing, I didn't realize at the time, he'd gotten out of Tanzania. He didn't even know about the charges till he got back to America safe. And I met with him. His wife is about to have twins last October. So I got together with him and said, yeah, so Tundu, you know, we were talking twin stuff. I have twins too. And he said, I said, so what are you going to do after the twins are born? And he said, well, I'm going back to Tanzania. One, he had to go back to Tanzania because when the World Resources Institute refused to pull its report, the Bush administration pulled $3 million from the organization. They pulled his visa, so he'd have to go back. But he said, no, I want to go back. I have to go back. I can't let this lie stand. And so he did go back, and he was arrested. He's been in and out. A member of the opposition who complained in Parliament was beaten till he was hospitalized. Witnesses have disappeared. His partners arrested and law offices ransacked and burnt down. And the story continues, but the reason I especially want to bring this up here is that are there members of ELAW here, ELA, ELAW, which it's here, his defenders are here in Oregon, in Eugene, based out of Eugene, Oregon. And so now you've got a job. Now you've got a job. See, this is not a passive discussion, guys. This is a meeting to get something done, okay? And one thing you're gonna do is you're gonna help out this organization to save this guy's life and remember those guys whose lives were buried, because they want to not only bury them, they want to bury the truth. Don't let them do it. Don't let them do it. And if we have to knock doors and tell people, you're not going to read it in the Oregonian. You're not going to read it in the New York Times. You're going to hear it here, okay? And we're going to spread that word. And one way you're going to do it, you're going to go to my website, www.gregpalast.com. G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T. How original. .com. And you'll get the continuing word on what's going on there. Well, in fact, speaking of getting some stuff done, something else our president said, and I thought it was a special message for the people of Portland. He said, the tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near. He's talking about Enron and PGE, right? And I assume so, because terrific work, guys. I was here 1 year ago, and I said, you have homework to do. You're going to take over this company and make it public. And actually, I understand that now, terrific, the Oregon Public Power Coalition has gotten the issue of public takeover on the ballot for September. There it is. That's right, they've got this. In fact, they've got this wonderful thing. This is, some people thought this was George Bush's spine. No, it isn't. It's a bumper sticker that says, kick Enron's thieving butt out of Oregon. And I wish that they would, I've asked them, you shouldn't be subtle with these things. Well, yeah. Let me talk to you about that. Again, we're here to get some work done, okay? And First of all, there's some giants here working on this. Where's Dan Meek? Is he here? Where's Dan? Stand up. It should be easy to see because he's like 9 feet tall, at least morally, politically. Here's Nancy Newell right here. Please stand up. Please stand up, the organ. There's your right. Will the OPPC people please stand up because I want you to recognize these people. Okay, because what we do need is your leaders. And if you read the new version of the book, I need you to forget. By the way, some of you got my hardbound version of the book. You're going to have to, you know, give it to grandma because it's been totally rewritten. Because of British censorship, it's almost twice as long. It has a special new chapter called California Reman about the power pirates and Enron. The real story they still haven't told you, see, because they don't want to tell you the full story. They want to tell you about battled Enron and that they're going away. It's, you know, it tells you... trying to tell you in that story about like guys like Jake Horton. See where it really began. See, they tell you that Enron is the bad apple. You know, I'm going to tell you about the whole friggin' tree is rotten from the roots down. And in 1989, I was investigating a company called Southern out of Atlanta. And they had a vice president named Jake Horton who recognized that he was going to take the fall because the company was caught bribing utility commissioners. Can you imagine such a thing? And they're going to make him take the fall. I said, well, I think what I'm going to do is go to the Attorney General and Board of Directors. I'm going to go to the Attorney General and mention that there's some funny business with bookkeeping in this company. In fact, what happened was that the company kept a second set of books, a multi-billion dollar corporation, kept the second set of books in the trunk of the car of the vice president for accounting. A little bit unusual, and they were indicted. I was working on this, and they were indicted, by the way, just about to be indicted by a grand jury. Well, Jake was about to blow the whistle, so he borrowed the company plane 10 minutes after it takes off. Boom. And Jake is spread out over Atlanta. And when BBC, which I work for, asked the company CEO later about Jake, the CEO said, poor Jake, I guess he saw no other way out. Yeah. But these guys saw another way out. They are facing the indictment, and they went to Daddy Bush's Justice Department, which then stopped the U.S. attorney pulled the U.S. attorney from seeking the indictment. They let the company off the hook, and they said, well, we can't indict these guys for criminal behavior, or Jake, because their methods were approved by that upstanding accounting firm, Arthur Andersen, right? So that was the beginning, when the Bush family said, hire our friends at Art Andersen, and it's a get-out-of-jail-free card. And that was the beginning, and it was that point that launched all those companies that... And so they removed what was called the Uniform System of Accounts, creating Enron, creating Global Crossing, which, by the way, gave George Herbert Walker Bush, for a single speech, $13 million. Hell of a speech, man. I wish I had heard it. $13 million, having nothing to do, I suppose, with eliminating all the rules on accounting, which they needed before they could suck down $100 billion and go bankrupt. Global Crossing, represented today by Richard Perle. I don't want people making connections here. You know. So you got work to do. See, because it's not just Enron, it's all those power pirates. See, Southern has now taken Enron's place as the number one power company in America, and they're not telling you who's bidding for PGE, are they? I'll tell you who's bidding for it. It's Southern and the other power pirates, right? So you're just gonna change the shape of the Jolly Roger on top, right? So here's what you do. First, you need your leaders. You need Nancy Newell and you need Dan Meeks. You listen to your leaders. And I want to tell you about Nancy. She's a special gift from. I come from Long Island. We've worked together for many years. And many years ago, Nancy and I discovered that the company Long Island Lighting was lying. Can you imagine a power company lying to the public? And for example, they lied and they said, I found I found a report at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which said that if the plant ever was, you know, hit by a truck or hit by a terrorist plane or an explosion, that the plant would be safe. And then I found the original, actual report written by the engineer, in which the word, can withstand an attack. The original report said cannot withstand an attack, and they just, you know, changed it, and took them to court for racketeering. But we also did something else. Okay, we began a public power movement, and like the public power movement here, OPPC has said that they, I believe you have $800 in the bank. Is that correct? $800 in the bank to fight Enron. And if you buy, I have some tapes out there, if you buy them, proceeds will go to OPIC. But that's enough to begin with. I want more going to this organization. But we saw the same thing back in Long Island. And here, the new president of your Enron subsidiary, PGE, has said he will spend whatever it takes to defeat Nancy and Dan and OPPC in September. Whatever it takes of your money. You know, they haven't paid their property taxes or their state taxes. They'll take whatever it takes out of that while your schools are going under. Whatever it takes of the pension money that's left, whatever it takes, they'll defeat you with that. And whatever it takes, you know, of your ratepayer money, whatever it takes. But now we're going to do whatever it takes. And let me tell you what we did on Long Island. We also started with $800 versus several billion. They had 500 lawyers today, and we had the highest electric rates in the nation when we began. Today, it is now the Long Island Public Power Authority. It's an $8 billion takeover by the public. The company was put out of business, bankrupted. We took them over, and the first thing we did is we gave every ratepayer on Long Island, 2 million people, got checks for $100 each, and our rates are some of the lowest in New York because we own it. We own it. And we own it because we fought for it. So when I come back next time, I know that it will be the Portland Public Power District. So you got to sign up. Sign up on my website too. There'll be sheets at the back, and I'll be helping. I'll be trading those with Nancy and the crew. But let me go back to who's winning. You know, the war on terror, right? Bush said, he's going after those who are harboring, training Al Qaeda, and I was very interested in that. So, who was harboring the friends of terrorists? And I'm interested in that because, see, I got this document. And at the top, it says secret. Always interesting. Why do they say secret? That's the first thing I go for. Secret. And it says, on the left side here, it says 199I, which means National Security, WF, which means Washington Office of the FBI. By the way, anyone here from the FBI? Because I got your... Come up later if you want. Very interesting document. And actually, I should tell you how I got it. You'll see throughout the book, I have all these documents marked secret, confidential from the World Bank and from, and I usually am a little bit, I usually don't tell you. But, and by the way, if you have any secret documents, I have a coupon at the back of the book that you cut out and you staple to the document. So tell me if you need to, we might have to take a 2-second break here. So let me tell you how I got this document, which is that the FBI came to our offices in Washington, my team. And they asked some questions, and then they kind of, when they left, they left a folder on the desk. So then they called up in panic and they said, we left a folder on your desk. They said, you haven't read it. You haven't looked at it, have you? Wah. No. And they said, so we'll be back in 30 minutes to get it. unless you need 45. So what do you think that these guys maybe wanted me to take a look at, huh? Well, it's very interesting because it said that it's just a report that says that they're getting that the FBI is looking for the right was finally released to go after guys who are listed as running a quote suspected terrorist organization. Right? That's what we're always it is what we pay the FBI to do besides, you know, go after pie throwing anti-globalization protesters, but they're only released to do so on September 13th, 2001. Otherwise, they were not allowed to go after the suspected terrorist organization. Well, who couldn't they go after? And I turned to page 2 and, whoa, there's the name Bin Laden, Omar and Abdul, two guys. Not Osama. Now, that was very interesting. Two guys in the United States. Now, I didn't understand this because, see, you have to understand, our president and his daddy have said, you know, the Bin Ladens, they're really just folks. And, you know, after all, they've funded Carlyle Corporation, and they and their buddies in Saudi Arabia have funded all our oil operations, Harkin Oil. They're our friends with Adnan. And, so they're good guys. There's only this one black sheep, Osama. But see, the FBI thought that there were a couple gray sheep that they ought to talk to, but they weren't allowed to. By the time they were released after the attack of September 11th, these two birds had flown. See? The FBI agents were not too happy about being told not to look. Why didn't we see what was coming? And they said, because we were told not to look. Now, the one thing I want to be very, very clear about, we had no evidence, and I'm not kidding you, at BBC or the Guardian papers, that Bush knew in advance about the attack of September 11th. In fact, and that he knew something, we just had no evidence. In fact, our rule at BBC is that if anyone ever accuses George W. Bush of knowing anything at all, you better have documentation. And that's true. We're tough on, we're strict. And, but what we're talking about is a money poisoning of our system, as the agents said, and the CIA agents and the DIA agents and the FBI agents and all at all levels said we could not, it's not a career maker to say, we should be looking into, we'd like to open an investigation into our, president's law, as president's partners, business partners, and his daddy's business partners. And among the other things they're told that they could not look at, for example, you remember training, harboring Al-Qaeda and Osama's guys? Well, see, for publishing that FBI story and several other related matters, we received, BBC and The Guardian, my team, received an award from the California State University for having one of the most censored stories of the year in America. In other words, this was all over the world. Actually, this is really true. Noam Chomsky said, I saw your story on the front page of the Times of India when he was in Delhi. He says, why wasn't that in the American papers? That was one of the weirdest. I started explaining to Chomsky, well, some news in America is manufactured, and it was like this weird reverse. It's why I don't understand why he's 74 and has hair. but it was great. But it was fun. So we got this award for a story which was kind of blacked out, smashed up against the electronic Berlin Wall. I did get it on KBOO, by the way. The crack in the electronic Berlin Wall, picking up Democracy Now and. So this one of the other things we learned about when we talk about harboring training Al-Qaeda is that we had on a State Department official who said that during the 1980s, he's a lawyer, said that during the 1980s he was asked to issue visas to guys from Saudi Arabia who said that they were engineers going to an engineering conference. And he said, okay, what engineering school did you go to? And they said, we don't remember. suspecting that something might be wrong, he denied the visas, and then they pulled him over the intelligence agencies and State Department chiefs and said, no, you issue the visas. So he looked around and said, who are these guys? He said, well, they work for this terrific guy who's helping us out in Afghanistan named Osama bin Laden, see? And so they were taken to the United States, where we trained and harbored them to send off against the evil Russian bear in Afghanistan. Except, see, terrorists kind of work like homing pigeons. They come back, see? It's just like, see, so it's more Frankensteins that we create. And the administration is so shocked when the Frankensteins created out of their Frankenstein factory come back and haunt us. You know, like the other thing that we discovered, you'll find the book that we also reported, is that how did Saddam Hussein get this like nuclear radioactive erector set in the rumpus room of his palace? You know, where did he get that stuff? And it turns out, I just spoke to a chief arms inspector, nuclear arms inspector for the UN a couple days ago, and he thanked the Guardian for identifying seven of the $10 billion that Saddam spent on his failed nuclear program. It doesn't work, but $7 billion coming from the Saudis during the, now how did that happen? How could that happen without the United States knowing about it and letting it happen? That Saddam got billions for his nuclear program. Because, you know, once you got, it's not only the money, but then you have to go out to, you know, Nukes R Us and, you know, buy all the stuff. And the answer is that this was during the Reagan-Bush administration when this was, see, it was before the Axis of Evil. See, Saddam was our butcher in Baghdad. You know, that's where we got our chops, and he was fighting those nasty Iranians. See, so we gave him the nuclear stuff to use against the Iranians. Right, because this is before the Axis of Evil, when the Iranians were kind of the unicycle of evil, see? And so it came back to us. So that's what I'm saying, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable times at the ranch at this holiday if they're really going after those who've supported terrorism, Dad. Now, by the way, no agent said to me, you know, we could have only gotten those bad guys, the hijackers, if only we didn't have some, you know, this Bill of Rights business. We could have gotten those hijackers if we only had an internal spying agency. We can't use the term, by the way. Total information awareness has now been banned by the U.S. Congress, which is good. So they need a new name. I've suggested KGB. And so they said, we could have gotten these guys. No one said we could have gotten these guys if we had a big apparatus, you know, the Fatherland Homeland Security Administration. No, they said, you know, if we maybe stood a chance if only the Bush family had gotten its foot off our neck, right, Dad? But that, yeah, they said we could have gotten them if we only beat up a couple kids in Portland, right? So who's winning the war? Who's winning the war? I mean, war on terror, we know who's gonna, you know, we have our nominees to win the war on Iraq, Carlisle, Lockheed, Khashoggi, Pearl. Who's winning the war on terror? Fairchild. Well, Forbes magazine said, it's a company called, said, this is a quote from Forbes, that the winner of the war on terror is a company called Choice Point. So who are they? Well, they're getting cool stuff. One of the reasons they're winning is that they have databases, 16 billion records on Americans. Cool for data mining, right? The day that they removed medical care for pregnant women, the same day that money was moved over, $1 billion moved over to the FBI to expand its DNA database. They want your blood. And so who is the kind of vampire outfit that's supplying the DNA information? Choice Point. They do the airport screening, the immigration intake. They're ringing that terrorism cash register. but who are these guys? So for that, see, it rang a bell with me. I have to go, I'm going to have to take you back to the 2000 election.
Now, wait. I know we're supposed to move on, right?
But you, if you want to know who's winning the war now, you have to know who won the election then, see? So back at that time, I was, I worked for a TV program called Newsnight in Britain. I had the night off after the election. Actually, Michael Moore was on instead, and
really.
And I was kind of winding down at home, watching, and I'm seeing black faces come in front of our BBC cameras saying, you know, I couldn't vote in Florida. You know, it's here in Florida, I showed up and my name wasn't on the voter rolls. One black face after another saying that they couldn't, you know, they weren't allowed to vote because they said that they weren't qualified, they were felons. By the way, just so you know, BBC has a rule that we're allowed to show black people who aren't criminals, right? And but then I'm looking, I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking like kind of conspiracy nut that I am. For those of you who watch Politically Incorrect, you know that I've been called a conspiracy nut. Which, you know, yeah, that's right. It always gets a laugh from the conspirators, right? And I'm thinking, conspiracy nut that I am, that there's some type of computer program. There's some type of computer program that's actually kind of hunting black voters on the voter rolls and removing their names. So I want to show you that program that I got out of Catherine Harris's office. Right here, see? There it is. This is how the election was won. This really is the list. What it is a list of 57,700 voters. You can come up later when you know, I'll sign all the books and all that stuff, and you can ask questions. You can see this list. This is how your president was elected. It's a list of 57,000 people who were felons, criminals, not allowed to vote in the state of Florida. So their names, they had illegally registered. Their names were removed. I said, okay, that's the law. What's interesting, so I decided, but no American reporter, when they heard it, some heard about the list and questioned it, but none of them looked at it. And I got it and looked at it, and I went down the list, and I'm not kidding you, this is the actual list. And if you look down here, it says, Thomas Cooper was one name I saw. He was convicted of a felony on January 30th, 2007. Ooh. Ecstasy, those of you who thought Minority Report was just a film, right? It was like Catherine Harris, detective of the future. You know, she goes out and finds the bad guys before they even do the deed, you know, and says, yeah, well, you're not going to vote in Florida, buddy. Why am I laughing? Because the Dalai Lama said, you know, would it help if I cried, right? So I'm looking, it's not just Thomas Cooper. There are 500 criminals of the future. Ooh. And we went through, I mean, you can look through this list, you know, J.C. Smith, you know, matched up, you know, I'm just looking, Johnny Jackson Jr., who's of Texas, John Fitzgerald Jackson, not Jr., has middle name, he loses his right to vote here. 90.2% of the people on this list, let me repeat that, 90.2% minimum. People on this list are innocent of any crime except they're guilty of something. Let me read this to you. Right-hand column, BLA, WHI, WHI, BLA, BLA. Ooh, their race is written right next to their name. Over half the people on this list and over half the people who are innocent on this list are BLA, black voters. Uh-huh. Demographically, that means, you figure not everyone votes. Some probable Bush voters here. This first list, and we found many more, but this first list alone cost Al Gore 20,000 votes minimum, according to the demographers. And on a race determined officially by 537 votes. And I'm interested, so who came up with this list that shows your president? Oh, wait, first I want to ask, we have to get to one other issue. Was it deliberate? Okay. Was it deliberate? So I went back and looked at the email traffic within the Department of Elections, and sure enough, there were clerks who said, my God, we're removing the civil rights of people who are convicted in the future. What do we do? Now, I know you've been to Portland schools, but nevertheless, you'd probably say, hey, give them back their civil rights, right? Mm-mm. The Republican leaders said, if you blank out the conviction dates, no one will know there are 4,000 blank conviction dates here, convicted in no time. So who came up with this nice little list? Well, first there was a company that paid $5,000 a year to come up with the list. They were fired by the Republicans. And they put it the purging of the voter list out for bid, and then they threw out the bids and took the highest bidder and gave them the job, an interesting Republican-connected company. The prior company paid $5,000 a year, and this new company paid $2 million for the first year. Now, I thought, now no American, I don't know why, in Britain we thought that was kind of interesting, worthy of investigation. Who are these guys? Well, the excuse for hiring these guys at, like, you know, 100,000% more than the other companies was that they could actually make sure that they didn't make any mistakes because they had 16 billion records on all Americans so they could cross-check. Choice Point, the winners of the War on Terror. Okay. The guys who picked the War on Terror have now been picked, who picked the president have now been picked by our president, okay, to collect, right? So I was very interested in 2 million. So how did, first of all, by the way, the 16 million, because if you check these names, they had people's addresses and credit card numbers, driver's license records, it would have shrunk to, according to the experts, from 57,000 to 57. One out of 1,000 may have been illegally registered. But hey, what else? Why 2 million? Even that's a lot for the record check. It was explained when I found the document. There it goes again, marked secret and confidential. Why do they put that on? It's like I go right for it. So I found this document. It's in the book. They're paid 2 million specifically for, quote, manual verification using telephone calls. In other words, when you're going to remove people's civil rights, you don't just, you know, match up a name and a date and a birth date and a race. You call around to make sure you got the right guys, you know. There's all kinds of methods of verification. And you keep lists, call lists, the experts tell me. So I called Choice Point and asked for their call lists, you know, the thousands of calls that you'd have to make. They said, you know, there are no call lists. Really? I mean, $2 million to make the calls? You didn't keep any records? I mean, you know, no records? Not even like, a number or two on like a sticky pad or something? No. They said, well, see, you have to understand, Mr. Pallast, that we actually didn't have to, the state said we didn't actually have to dial the telephones to make these calls. Now, in Oregon, I knew you'd understand this, because it's like a kind of new age, especially in when I was in Corvallis, they all said, yeah, of course, you don't have to dial a phone, you know, calls, no dialing, and you know, I'm like trying to get my head into this space. I have a Welsh director said, forget it, Pallast, call up Catherine and ask her what this is about. Calls without dialing for $2 million. So she set me up to meet with her elections chief, who is her like political Doberman, poodle, guy, beady-eyed guy named Clayton Roberts. So I brought in the BBC cameras And we had a sat down, nice, polite interview, and chit-chat. I show him the $2 million, photocopy of the $2 million check. He gives Choice Point, and then I begin to pull out the secret and confidential paper to ask him about it. And suddenly, God knows why, he rips off his microphone, lapel microphone, does a 50-yard dash across the camera wires, locks himself in his office, and calls in the state troopers to remove me and my camera crew from the state building. Well, you know, I guess he had another appointment, right? And so then, but now here's the weird one. While he's doing the 50-yard dash, and I'm being, you know, like, you know, frog marched out the building with my cameras, PBS is filming me, filming Roberts. Do, 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 right? And it's like, now, this is a problem for PBS, because this, you know, here they have this long tradition which has now been broken. They actually have serious investigative reporting footage. Right, now what do you do with it? Now they also had the problem that the director that they put on this film about the Florida election and the aftermath is a great Emmy Award-winning director, Danny Schechter. And he says, hey, great footage. He shows the Roberts bunny hop. He shows the documents. He shows the scrub list with the blacks being removed from the voter rolls. He hands it to PBS, and they say, oh, thanks, Dan. And you know what? I don't think we should put this up on the satellite. We're not going to transmit this on satellite. There are all kinds of reasons, and I know how difficult it was for PBS, so just to help them out, I made several thousand copies of it. It's true. I got like 20 or 25 here just to kind of, you know, do the samizdat thing. After Patriot Act 4, you know, show it in your basement. But for like, it's like $20 to cover our costs, and I'll be giving whatever's a hunk of that to Nancy and the public power commandos afterwards. And I'll sign all your books and answer all that stuff. But I wanted, besides PBS, you almost saw it on CBS. And actually you're hearing this dance track about called Silence of the Media Lamps. So you can get, that's right. So you were all waiting for the movie? No, you're going to have the dance, the CD. But it was almost on CBS. Now, you have to understand, I get along with these characters. Dan Rather was on my television show in Britain, and he said, you know, Greg, he didn't say Greg because it was another reporter talking to him. He said, you know, I would love to ask tough questions. And I know we got our kids going into Asia and the Mideast, and we should be asking tough questions on TV. He says, I'm not going to ask the tough questions because I'll be lynched as unpatriotic. That's what Dan Rather said. Silence is patriotism. No questions. Now, before that, see, CBS, his news program, had called me and said, ooh, listen, Greg, that is such a cool story about, you know, the blacks being pulled off the voter rolls and everything. Can we do some of that story? We're down here in Florida, you know, we're taking pictures of hanging chads and stuff. Can we have some of that story? And I said, sure. They said, but give us something new. And I said, I got something new for you. Jeb Bush's office is in on it, the governor. And I said, what do you mean? I said, the governor wrote a letter 6 weeks before the election. The date of the letter is September 18th, 2000. It's been read to me by two sources. I don't have it. Get that letter. Because Jeb's office ordered the removal and of thousands of legal voters, and barring the registration of voters who are legal, 50,000 legal voters, almost everyone a Democrat. That's in addition to Kate's little list. And I said, oh, great. Thanks, Greg. Week goes by, nothing. So I call CBS Evening News. I say, hey, gents, you asked for the story. You didn't do it. What happened to the letter? They said, well, Greg, your story didn't stand up. I hear this all the time from Americans. Your story didn't stand up. He says, okay, why is it limping? Tell me what happened. You know, I mean, you got $2 billion CBS operation, you know. I mean, some of these things just don't work out. So tell me what your investigation was. I said, well, we called Jeb Bush's office, and they denied it. No letter. Palace had it wrong. Okay. I could have done that. You know, I didn't even think of doing that. It's so sophisticated there. But my producer thought we should look a little bit, keep looking anyway, despite CBS. But I was having some trouble getting the actual letter out of their office. A reporter at CBS.com was having some success, though he was let go quickly. Dave Rupi, another great reporter, I thought I should mention. You know, I, by the way, almost got on US TV, just so you do know. I've just moved back from England, and I got an agreement to be a regular on the Phil Donahue show. And this is true. Close. Unfortunately, I saw Phil's, the body of his bullet-riddled career hanging out the window at MSNBC. I guess Peter Arnett didn't notice that. Didn't get the idea. why am I laughing? I was looking for the letter, and I didn't have any success till I wrote a piece of this story finally in Harper's Magazine, which, by the way, last week we were just nominated for the Magazine Pulitzer Prize for. Which is the National Magazine Awards, but Kate wrote a letter to Harper's saying, you know, that's where that phrase came in. She said, Greg Palast is twisted and maniacal. that may be true. I don't know. I'll check it out. But she didn't say I was wrong. See, the NAACP, and she couldn't, the NAACP sued after we ran the story. You read about that in the Oregonian, right? And she signed off. She said, yeah, we did it. We did it. We're sorry. It's not my fault, she said. It's not my fault. Everyone else told me to do it. The Attorney General, the legislature, and the governor wrote me a letter. So I called up her office. I didn't say this is Mr. Twisted and Maniacal. I just said, I got a letter from the Secretary of State, and she's mentioning a letter she received from the governor. It's about the felon voters on the voter rolls, and I'm sure she wants me to see it so we can talk about it. She references it. And, you know, could you send it to me? You know, I think I'm quite sure it's dated September 18th, 2000. Anyway, 10 minutes later in my fax machine, there it is. Dan, here I found it. Here it is. Man. And there it is. And here we are. So I want to leave you with, sign books, answer questions out there. As much time as you need. But I want to leave you with one final thought from our president. Why did Michael call him a fictitious president? He said, our president said, and I agree with him, do not fight for a dying regime. It is not worth your life. Thank you.
This year, Watergate 30.